In this video, we are going to be covering the life of one of the most interesting people to ever live, Edgar Mitchell. Edgar Mitchell was one of the original Apollo astronauts and the sixth man to walk on the moon. After his time with NASA, Edgar Mitchell would go on to pursue subjects like consciousness, psychic phenomena, remote viewing, and UFOs. Edgar Mitchell would get into some subjects that are considered woo-woo, and I'm not telling you to agree with all of his conclusions on these subjects. But we are going to cover his life and his relationship with these subjects as he claims to have experienced them out of respect for the man. We are spoiled today where it seems like every week there is a new esteemed scientist or mainstream politician saying that UFOs are real and need to be seriously addressed. But this openness with the media and government officials regarding UFOs is a new and recent phenomena, and for many years, Edgar Mitchell was the most high-profile advocate for the reality of the UFO phenomena, and need for addressal by society and the government, during a time when doing so made you the subject of extreme ridicule. Edgar Mitchell's life has so much fascinating history that we will be covering a lot of traditional history topics that his life touched on, so be warned, if you want strictly UFOs, this might not be the video for you. By examining his life, we learn about the history of rocketry, advancements in aviation, the Apollo program, New Age thinking of the 1970s, the CIA's research into remote viewing, and of course, UFOs. Maybe you will view this story as a man gone off the deep end, or maybe you will view this story as a man too ahead of his time. Some of the main sources for this video were the book The Way of the Explorer, an Apollo astronaut's journey through material and mystical worlds, Edgar Mitchell's autobiography released in 1996, Earthrise, My Adventure as an Apollo 14 Astronaut, released in 2014, a biography written by Ellen Mahoney and Edgar Mitchell that is geared towards middle and high school level readers, and Annie Jacobson's The Phenomena, The Secret History of the U.S. Government's Investigation into Extrasensory Perception and Psychokinesis, released in 2016. All books are linked in the description. I also listened to a bunch of Edgar Mitchell interviews researching for this video. Edgar Dean Mitchell was born on September 17, 1930 in Hartford, Texas, to a cattle ranching family. He learned how to ride horses and herd cattle at a young age. He was a literal cowboy, and he really enjoyed riding fast on his horse. He played violin and guitar and was a fan of Buck Rogers. When Edgar Mitchell was 4 years old, he would have his first flight. A Jenny biplane ran out of fuel and landed on his family's pasture. Edgar's father helped the pilot get gas, and in return for the kind gesture, the pilot gave Edgar and his father a ride in his biplane. At this point, flying was only 30 years old, and Edgar and his father had never flown before. From that first flight as a child, Edgar Mitchell fell in love with flying. Pretty soon, the Dust Bowl caused the Mitchell family ranching business to fall into disarray, so the family moved east to start from scratch. The Mitchell family ended up settling in Roswell, New Mexico in 1935 to start anew. An interesting historical nugget from this time is that Edgar Mitchell states that when he was walking to 3rd and 4th grade, he would often pass the property of a man the community referred to as the Mad Scientist. This man was Robert Goddard, a pioneer of modern rocket propulsion. Born in 1882, Robert Goddard believed that man's best chance of reaching outer space and the moon was through rocket technology. In the 1920s, Goddard began to seriously test and develop different aspects of modern rocket technology. The American society and the scientific community of that time saw little interest in rocket technology, as they were still infatuated with the recently invented airplanes. In fact, Goddard was chastised in the media for thinking that rockets could get man to the moon. After nearly burning down a building in Massachusetts with his rocket experiments, Goddard would relocate to Roswell, New Mexico in 1930, with the financial help of Charles Lindbergh, one of the few who saw the potential in what he was doing. In Roswell, New Mexico, chosen for the barren landscape, Goddard would continue to develop rocket technology. He is credited with 214 patents. Robert Goddard created the first liquid fuel rocket. He shot a scientific payload in a rocket flight, received the U.S. patent for a multi-stage rocket, developed gyro control apparatus for the rocket flight, and launched a rocket with motor pivoted on gimbals under the influence of a gyro mechanism. I find it amazing that while Robert Goddard was in Roswell, New Mexico developing rocket technology, a young Edgar Mitchell would walk past this man's property every day. Robert Goddard's works and theories would one day help get this kid to the moon. Even though the American public was uninterested in Goddard's rocketry developments, the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany both had spies closely monitoring Goddard's work to aid in the development of their respective rocketry programs. Both the Soviet Union and the Nazi government saw the value in rocket technology and invested heavily in this field. Pretty soon, World War II would begin, and America would have to play catch-up. Robert Goddard would die of throat cancer during the war. Edgar Mitchell was 9 years old when World War II began, and like most Americans, his family did not own a television. Most of what he learned from the war came from listening to the radio.
Just to bring you up to date on the news of Europe, if you are just turning on your radios, Great Britain is now at war with Germany. Prime Minister...
Japanese have attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and our defense facilities at Manila, capital of the Philippines.
Some major developments of World War II Edgar Mitchell was able to witness, however. Walker Air Force Base, later named Roswell Army Airfield, soon opened in Roswell, New Mexico. And the young aviation enthusiast Edgar Mitchell soon began seeing various different aircraft flying in formation and running exercises in the skies above his town. Edgar Mitchell also claims there were a few nights where he would hear a loud explosion, feel the ground shake, and then the night sky would be illuminated in the distance near the Captain Mountains. He soon learned that these events were the result of the atomic weapons tests that were taking place at the White Sands Proving Ground. During the war, his family would move from Roswell to Artesia, a few towns over. At the age of 14, Edgar Mitchell got a job cleaning and repairing airplanes at the local airport to help pay for flying lessons. He did his first solo flight at 14 in a Piper J3 Cub, and remembers being very nervous about landing, but when he was able to successfully land the airplane, he was very proud of himself. By 16 years old, Edgar Mitchell had his pilot's license, and he would fly whenever he could. He learned to map the area from above, and would often scare the cattle on his family's property by flying close to the ground near them. When he was 17 years old, Edgar Mitchell was front and center for another major historical event.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection.
Edgar Mitchell clearly remembers when the Army reported that they had recovered a flying disc on a cattle ranch near Roswell, New Mexico, and the townsfolk being really confused. He and a friend listened to the radio all day for updates. What did this mean? Were there really aliens? Are things going to change? Edgar Mitchell and his friend decided that the next day they would ride their bikes to the crash site and see for themselves. However, the Army soon recanted their initial statement and instead said what was recovered was a weather balloon. Like many Americans, Edgar Mitchell at the time believed the Army weather balloon cover story. He was 17 years old and a senior in high school and getting ready for college. In high school, he got good grades and participated in many extracurricular activities. His work paid off, and in 1948, he was accepted into Carnegie Institute of Technology, now Carnegie Mellon. Edgar Mitchell graduated from Carnegie Institute of Technology in 1952. Initially, he was nervous about being considered a hick by the other kids at school, but he excelled at university. He studied industrial management to help with his family's cattle and now farm equipment business back home. In his first year, he met Lewis Randall, and they married in 1951. Although his plan initially was to go and work on his family's agriculture business, in 1952, he decided to join the Navy in order to avoid getting drafted for the Korean War. In May of 1953, he completed instruction at the Officer Candidate School at Newport, Rhode Island. In 1954, he completed U.S. Navy Flight School and was stationed in Pensacola, Florida, and San Diego, California, flying P-2V Neptunes. His first deployment was at 24 in Okinawa, Japan, and he was assigned to Patrol Squadron 29, tasked with patrolling the waters near Japan, Korea, and China. He recounts that the last day before the end of his first deployment, he was shot at by two enemy fighter jets near Shanghai, China. He had to do a dramatic nosedive to avoid getting shot as he could see the tracers from the enemy's munitions near his own jet. He then transitioned to aircraft carrier-based jet aircraft and flew the A-3D Sky Warrior while assigned to Heavy Attack Squadron 2 deployed on aircraft carrier USS Ticonderoga. He recalls being nervous about landing on aircraft carriers at first, but he remembered his first solo landing and was able to successfully learn to land an aircraft on carriers. Edgar Mitchell would hear from his fellow pilots about UFOs outflying our jets in the Korean theater, and he didn't know what to think, having not seen one himself. He did note that the pilots who did see things were reluctant to talk about their encounters for fear of ridicule and reprisal. He would fly in the Korea conflict for 3 years before the Navy recognized his skill as a pilot, and he was transferred to test flight duty at China Lake, California in 1957. Edgar Mitchell began to become disenchanted with war, and his talents being used for war. This feeling would only increase with his new test flight duty at China Lake. At his current post, he was helping the military develop different aircraft that could easily drop nuclear weapons. Edgar Mitchell would fly various aircraft with dummy nuclear payloads to see how they would respond to various stimuli. Even though he was carrying dummy payloads, Edgar Mitchell was growing disgusted with the role he was playing in the nuclear arms race. He remembered the ground shaking and the sky illuminating from the White Sands test when he was a child. Now as an adult, he was fully aware of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the destruction that atomic weapons were capable of. He wanted no part of it, and was desperately trying to think of a way he could still be on the forefront of aviation, but not part of the war machine. Then an event happened that would alter his life's trajectory.
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket. You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite, one of the great scientific feats of the age.
Upon hearing that the Soviets had successfully launched a satellite using rocket technology, Edgar Mitchell was sure that humans would soon follow. Becoming a part of the space program was the kind of thing he had been hoping for. A way to be on the forefront of science, technology, and aviation, and a way to still serve his country, Edgar Mitchell assessed the playing field and realized he needed more schooling if he wanted to get into the astronaut program. In 1959, he was accepted into the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, where he received a Bachelor of Science in Aeronautics. Edgar Mitchell was keenly following all the developments regarding the U.S. space program and the creation of NASA. He did not make the Mercury program, the NASA program with the goal of successfully completing the first crewed orbital spaceflight. President Eisenhower had tasked some of the top American universities with creating graduate-level space programs for prospective NASA engineers and astronauts. Massachusetts Institute of Technology created a graduate program in space, science, and astronautics. Edgar Mitchell applied to this MIT program and was accepted, along with many other astronaut hopefuls. One of his classmates at MIT was future Apollo astronaut and second man to walk on the moon, Buzz Aldrin. Edgar Mitchell stated that all of his professors and classmates at MIT were very brilliant. They learned high levels of various different sciences. He recalls long debates with classmates about the nature of the universe and reality. In one of these debates, the prospect of alien life came up. He recalled the Army announcing that they had recovered an alien craft near his hometown in Roswell when he was a teenager. The way it made people uneasy and confused before the weather balloon correction. He also thought about the UFOs his fellow pilots would report in Korea and the ridicule they faced upon reporting. It was during this time of intense study that Edgar Mitchell realized how much he didn't know. He began to educate himself on various subjects, and this is when he began to dabble into works related to consciousness and parapsychology. He took particular interest in the work of J.B. Ryan, who founded the Parapsychology Lab at Duke University.
Dr. Ryan, if ESP really exists, what are its implications?
Well, it does really exist. It does really occur, we'd say. The implications begin with the basic fact that ESP is non-physical. It shows that there's something that man can do that extends beyond space-time.
The space race was continuing along, and the Soviets were winning. On November 3, 1957, the Soviet pupper Laika became the first living creature to be launched into Earth orbit. On April 12, 1961, Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin became the first human in space. America would send Mercury astronaut Alan Shepard into space less than a month after the Soviets put Gagarin in space. A month shy of greatness, felt by Alan Shepard and all of America. While Edgar Mitchell was at MIT, President Kennedy made his famous "We Choose to Go to the Moon" speech.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
And Edgar Mitchell says that his entire MIT graduate program was extremely enthusiastic with the prospect of actually being one of the men that might go to the moon. In 1964, he completed his doctoral thesis titled Guidance of Low-Thrust Interplanetary Vehicles and received his doctorate degree in aeronautics and astronautics from MIT. He then applied and hoped to be a part of NASA's second manned space program, Project Gemini. Unfortunately, Edgar Mitchell was not selected for Project Gemini. Edgar Mitchell then did a brief stint at the Manned Orbiting Laboratory in California, helping design orbital craft, but he felt that progress there was stalling, so he requested to be transferred to Edwards Air Force Base for more test pilot work. He figured this would be a good move, since many of the astronauts selected for the Project Mercury and Project Gemini programs were test pilots with thousands of hours of flight time in high-speed experimental aircraft. And after so many years of schooling, he wanted to get more flight time. In 1965, his request was granted and he was transferred to Edwards Air Force Base. Alongside being a test pilot flying the Lockheed NF-104A, he enrolled in the base's Aerospace Research Pilot School, which had recently added a space curriculum. Edgar Mitchell loved the environment at Edwards Air Force Base. He coincidentally got to fly under the legendary Chuck Yeager, who was the first man to break the sound barrier in 1947. And the test pilots at Edwards all got along really well, with lots of drinking and a healthy spirit of competition amongst all the men. Many of the test pilots there also had their eyes on space. Edgar Mitchell was actively applying to NASA this entire time. It was now 1966, 9 years since he had decided he wanted to be an astronaut. In that time he had gotten his doctorate from MIT, more flight hours including jets, worked at the Manned Orbiting Lunar Laboratory, and completed the Edwards Air Force Base Aerospace Test Pilot School. Then, one day while he was eating dinner with his family, he received a phone call telling him that he had been selected for NASA's Apollo program, the program with the goal of putting a man on the moon.
The Apollo spacecraft will consist of three modules. The command module will carry the three-man crew together with guidance, communications, and life support systems. The service module will contain propulsion systems for mid-course maneuvers, as well as for entering and escaping the lunar orbit. The lunar excursion module will carry two crew members to the surface of the moon, along with scientific instruments, communications, and guidance systems. It also will have a propulsion capability for a lunar landing and for return to the orbiting command and service modules.
Edgar Mitchell was selected for NASA Astronaut Group 5 in April of 1966 and immediately started Astronaut Ground School, which included refreshers in space science, astronomy, geology, orbital mechanics, computer science, spaceflight, and medical aspects of spaceflight. While the rest of Ed's family was preparing for the move, he rented an apartment with fellow Group 5 astronaut Fred Hayes. The two of them quickly grew very close and became great friends. Edgar Mitchell was excited to be accepted into the program, but going to the moon was still not a guarantee. The Apollo astronauts selected for missions were chosen from the Project Mercury and Gemini veterans, and from the two later astronaut groups that Ed was a part of. There was still a big pool of people all eyeing to go to the moon. Each moon mission consisted of three astronauts. Mission commander, who would oversee the mission and go to the moon. The lunar module pilot would pilot the craft that lands on the moon. And the command module pilot, who would stay in the command module orbiting the moon as the two other astronauts went to the moon on the lunar module. Ed thought that his best chance of getting to the moon was to focus on the lunar module as his technical assignment. And his roommate Fred Hayes agreed, and the two of them would fly up to Bethpage, Long Island often to assist in the design, manufacture, and testing of the lunar module at Grumman Aircraft Company, and they test-piloted many prototype models, giving feedback to the engineers. The Mitchell family soon moved to Houston, joining Ed, and work continued with great optimism. But less than a year after being accepted into the program, Ed and his fellow astronauts would be reminded of the dangers they were placing themselves in.
Good evening. Astronauts Virgil Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee have been killed in a flash fire during a rehearsal of the countdown and launch of the Apollo flight they were to have made on the 21st of next month. The accident occurred at Cape Kennedy. Here is a report of the event from NASA Public Affairs Officer Jay Vayman at Cape Kennedy, Florida.
Astronauts Virgil I. Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee were killed tonight in a flash fire during the test of Apollo Saturn 204 vehicle at Cape Kennedy Air Force Station. The fire occurred while the astronauts were in
the Apollo 1 fire was a tragic reminder of the dangers of space travel. Fred Hayes and Edgar Mitchell would fly in the four-plane missing angel formation over the memorial services in Houston while the Apollo 1 astronauts were being laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery. Ed states that the public was unusually prepared for the loss of life in the interest of getting a man on the moon before the Soviets. Everyone understood this had to be achieved, and work continued. Edgar Mitchell was soon selected to be one of the lunar module pilots for a mission to the moon. Initially, Edgar Mitchell was scheduled to be a part of Apollo 13, with Don Iles as his command module pilot and Gordon Cooper as his mission commander. Gordon Cooper was one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts and a man with his own crazy history with our subject of UFOs, but that's a story for another day. Gordon Cooper would not end up going to space again and retired, leaving the Apollo 13 crew in need of a mission commander. This is when Alan Shepard, the first American in space, the one who lost to Yuri Gagarin by a month, was chosen to replace Cooper as the mission commander. As mission commander, Alan Shepard would get to choose his crew. He would replace command module pilot Don Iles with Stu Russo. But Shepard would keep Edgar Mitchell as the lunar module pilot. Alan Shepard had recently had a surgery to fix a medical issue, so NASA officials thought it best that his flight be moved from Apollo 13 to Apollo 14, postponing Ed's moon trip by a few months. Ed's friend and old roommate Fred Hayes was scheduled to fly the lunar module port Apollo 13. Ed was bummed and jealous that his flight had been postponed, but those feelings soon went away. Ed was still going to the moon. With the assignments all worked out, Mission Commander Alan Shepard, Command Module Pilot Stu Russo, and Lunar Module Pilot Edgar Mitchell prepared for their mission. They were to land on the moon, set up instruments, collect samples, and return to Earth. The Apollo 14 crew began extensive training for their spaceflight. Their bodies were put under extreme conditions to help acclimate them for their trip. They needed to be ready for the G-forces of liftoff and the zero gravity of space. They would spin in the liftoff centrifuge in Westminster, Pennsylvania to simulate liftoff. Nobody liked this, and it was nicknamed the torture chamber by the astronauts. To simulate zero-G, they would take a ride in the KC-135, which would take a steep upward trajectory before diving into a near free fall, creating 20 to 60 seconds of zero-G. This was nicknamed the Vomit Comet because some of the astronauts would throw up after riding in this. They would train extensively underwater in Key West, Florida to help them get used to performing tasks in an altered weight state. They would go to multiple survival schools in case they landed in hostile territory upon re-entry. They would go to a jungle survival school in Panama, equipped with only a parachute and a first aid kit. They had to survive alone for a few days, eating bugs, frogs, and worms. They went to desert survival school in Pasco Desert in Washington, equipped again with a parachute and a first aid kit, this time with water. Along with testing their bodies physically, the Apollo 14 crew would spend countless hours rehearsing their trip and flying in the lunar module and command module simulators. These simulators were an exact replica of their respective spacecraft, down to the switches, displays, dials, controls, and communication equipment. They would fly through their planned mission thousands of times, and often they would have random challenges thrown at them like a meteorite hitting their spacecraft or a malfunction in one of the systems. The astronauts were expected to know the systems inside and out, and to be able to respond to these challenges rapidly. Along with the simulation training, the Apollo 14 crew did extensive geology training. They would earn the equivalent of a PhD in geology and be trained on how to identify and classify all different kinds of rocks. This would be important for their trip to the moon, where, after all the hoopla of getting there, they were to act as geologists on behalf of mankind, investigating the rocks on the moon. They would travel all over the world for this training. Some of Ed's favorite places he went to for this geology training were Astra, Iceland, Bavaria, Germany, the Grand Canyon, and even parts of his home state of New Mexico. As all this training was going on, Edgar Mitchell became friends with another character from history, Wernher von Braun. Wernher von Braun was born in Wirwitz, Germany, on March 23, 1912, to a wealthy family. As a child, he received a telescope, which made him interested in astronomy. At age 10, von Braun began reading Hermann Oberth's The Rocket into Interplanetary Space, which spurred his desire to better understand science and math as the subjects related to space exploration. One time as a child, von Braun tied as many fireworks as he could to a horse carriage just to see how fast he could make it go, an experiment he would be forever proud of. He dreamed of using rockets to get to space. With his new dedication to his studies, von Braun became a top student. In 1932, von Braun received his BS degree in mechanical engineering. Von Braun eventually attended the University of Berlin, where he received a doctorate in physics in 1934. Braun joined the German Society for Space Travel. In his spare time, he assisted Oberth, the man who inspired him, in his liquid-fueled rocket motor test. Von Braun hoped to work on development of rocket technology for getting to space. However, this time coincided with when the Nazis were coming to power in Germany, and they wanted von Braun to develop weapons for war. Private rocket research would be banned under the Nazis, and rocket development could only be conducted through the military. The degree to which von Braun was a hostage scientist of Nazis, or an enthusiastic supporter, is still fairly debated today. Von Braun oversaw the development of liquid-fueled rocket aircraft, jet-assisted takeoff, and the long-range ballistic missile A-4, later renamed the V-2 by Hitler himself. This rocket would devastate distant Nazi targets until the end of the war. This rocket was also built using thousands of slave laborers. Towards the end of the war, Wernher von Braun was briefly imprisoned by the Nazis after he was heard saying that the war is lost. He was quickly released because of his value, but he made the decision to surrender to the Americans rather than be captured by the Soviets who were 100 miles away and closing in on the east. With fake documents, he was able to make it through Germany, surrendering to the Americans. The Americans were keen to talk to von Braun, as he was at the top of the blacklist. the codename for the list of German scientists and engineers targeted for immediate interrogation. Eventually, von Braun became a part of Operation Paperclip, a secret United States intelligence program in which more than 1,600 German scientists, engineers, and technicians were taken from former Nazi Germany to the US for government employment after the end of World War II, avoiding any chance of being tried for war crimes. Now in the US, von Braun would once again be told to develop rockets for war and not space through the 1950s, until the space race was ushered in and he was finally given the green light and resources to help develop rockets that would take man to the moon. He was the first director of the Marshall Space Flight Center and the chief architect of the Saturn V, the giant rocket that would take the Apollo astronauts to the moon. This is where he would meet Edgar Mitchell during the Apollo days. Edgar Mitchell recounts that he and von Braun were assigned to share a hotel room for a weekend at some NASA conference. Edgar Mitchell was amazed and honored to be able to share a room and pick the brain of someone he considered to be one of the most brilliant men to ever live. Von Braun found Edgar Mitchell very interesting as well. He could not believe that Edgar Mitchell grew up in Roswell, New Mexico. He loved hearing the Roswell escapades of Robert Goddard, the American rocket scientist Edgar Mitchell used to refer to as the Mad Scientist. Robert Goddard was one of Wernher von Braun's biggest inspirations, and soon Edgar Mitchell and Wernher von Braun became very close friends. As Edgar Mitchell continued preparing for his space flight, he was also making personal preparations to conduct a secret ESP experiment while in space. Although his time at NASA was very intensive, he still made time to pursue his interest in parapsychology that began at MIT. He came across the book Thoughts Through Space, A Remarkable Adventure. This book was about experiments of telepathy taken in 1937 by Australian explorer Huber Wilkins and American author Harold Sherman. Australian explorer Hubert Wilkins was famed for exploring the Arctic. In one of his voyages, he began these experiments. Wilkins and Sherman's prearranged that each day, for a half-hour period at a certain hour, Sir Hubert would concentrate upon the significant happenings of the day, while at that same time, Sherman in New York would attempt to record any impressions about the expedition which came to his mind. Edgar Mitchell began scheming about how to recreate this experiment during his space flight. The Apollo program was continuing smoothly after the Apollo 1 fire, and eventually, Apollo 11 successfully landed Americans Neil Armstrong and Ed's MIT classmate, Buzz Aldrin, on the moon on July 24, 1969. Edgar Mitchell was in mission control for this historic moment.
2, 1, 0, all engines running.
Coming down the ladder now. I'm at the foot of the ladder. The LAM footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches. I'm going to step off the LAM now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Apollo 12 would successfully accomplish their mission shortly after. But Apollo 13, Ed's originally scheduled mission under Gordon Cooper, that his friend and old housemate Fred Hayes was now assigned to, would face extreme difficulties.
The flight of the Apollo 13 to the moon is in serious jeopardy this morning and is not going to make a moon landing. As the Apollo 13 was some 205,000 miles from Earth, speeding toward its rendezvous with the moon scheduled for tomorrow night, the fuel cells that supply it with electrical power suddenly failed. With this lack of power, the mission could not be completed to the moon, and it is now a question of getting the men home safely.
2.5 days after the launch of Apollo 13, the oxygen tank in the service module would explode, putting the astronauts' lives in jeopardy. The entire world watched and waited to see what would happen to the crew of Apollo 13. The astronauts needed to find a way to breathe, so they moved from the command module to the lunar module. With the service module compromised, the lunar module would now become the lifeboat of Apollo 13, with the lunar module engine to be used to get the astronauts around the moon and onto an orbital path for re-entry, something the lunar module was not designed for. Because Edgar Mitchell knew the lunar module inside and out, having helped design it, he was called into mission control. Ed wanted to be there to help get his fellow astronaut and his good friend Fred Hayes back home safely. Edgar Mitchell spent the following days in the lunar module simulator, running through countless procedures and scenarios, running re-entry after re-entry under different conditions, so the doomed astronauts in space would have the proper plan to re-enter given their limited fuel and power. The genius problem solvers at NASA were able to get the astronauts home safely, This mission was deemed a successful failure by President Nixon, and Edgar Mitchell received the Presidential Medal of Freedom for his contributions to the rescue efforts of Apollo 13. Although the astronauts survived, the Apollo 13 disaster put a lot of strain on NASA. These moon missions were very expensive. Man had already landed on the moon, and the appetite for footing the bill for these missions shrunk. A lot of pressure was now put onto Apollo 14 to have a successful mission. Anything less would result in an end of the entire Apollo program. Edgar Mitchell, Stu Rusa, and Alan Shepard all understood this, and soon enough their launch day of January 31st, 1971 arrived.
52nd mark in the count. At ignition and liftoff, we'll have more than 7.5 million pounds of thrust pushing the space vehicle off the launch pad. This is the heaviest Saturn V space vehicle to be launched thus far. Coming up on the 1 minute, 20 second mark. 1 minute, 20 seconds and counting, still go at this time. Third stage tanks now are pressurized according to our Stratus board here in the firing room. 1 minute, 10 seconds and counting. This is Kennedy Launch Control, coming up in 60 seconds. Mark, T-minus 60 seconds and counting. Still go with the count. First stage tanks are now pressurized as our status board gives us a rundown on the automatic sequence. 50 seconds and counting. We've now gone on internal power on the internal batteries of the Saturn V as the count continues. 40 seconds and counting. Alan Shepard reports that he's performing his final guidance alignment, the final maneuver the astronauts perform before liftoff. 30 seconds and counting. Stu Rusa just said, thanks, it's been a good count. 25 seconds and counting, we are still go. 20 seconds, guidance alert, the guidance system now going internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, ignition sequence start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Launch commit. Liftoff. We have liftoff with Apollo 14. 3 minutes past the hour. The tower is clear.
Houston is controlling. 16 seconds. Pitch and roll program started. 14 maneuvering to a proper flight course.
After a successful launch and jettisoning of the multi-stage Saturn V rockets, Apollo 14 was now in space and headed to the moon. They had a slight hiccup when trying to dock the lunar module and the command module, but that was quickly resolved. It would be about 4 days before they reached the moon. In the meantime, the astronauts checked all their instruments on the craft and rehearsed their upcoming procedures. This is also when Edgar Mitchell began to secretly conduct his ESP experiments he had planned back on Earth. During his personal time on the spacecraft, he conducted 4 private experiments with 4 individuals back on Earth, testing whether ESP might bridge up to 240,000 miles of space. Using numbers assigned to the 5 standard symbols, circle, cross, navy, wavy line, square, star, of ESP Zener cards, the 4 individuals on Earth were to try and write down the symbols in the same order Mitchell thought about them. This experiment had very questionable results, but I do respect Edgar Mitchell for doing it, the first psychic experiment in space. After 4 days, they reached the moon and began orbiting it. Here, Ed saw the dark side of the moon, where there was a communications blackout with Mission Control and Ed. And Ed was able to witness his first Earthrise, where the Earth rises out from beyond the horizon as the sun does on Earth. After a few orbits of the moon, Edgar Mitchell and Alan Shepard suited up and hopped out of the Kitty Hawk command module and into the Antares lunar module. Stu Rusa seemed nervous for the first time on the trip as he wished them well. He didn't know for sure if he would see them again. After all of that time at Grumman Aircraft designing and testing the lunar module, and all the hours spent in the simulators, it was now time for Edgar Mitchell to perform his duties. After double-checking all the systems, the lunar module separated from the command module. The mission plan was to orbit the moon 2 times in the lunar module before they began their descent to the lunar surface. Each orbit would take 2 hours, totaling 4 hours before they could make their descent. They successfully completed their first lunar orbit, when suddenly, an abort alarm started going off in the lunar module, and back at Mission Control. Nobody knew what was causing the support to go off, but if this occurred during the landing burn, the Antares would abort the mission automatically. Mission Control instructed Ed to hit the abort button. The sound soon stopped, but moments later it started once again. Mission Control would have 2 hours to figure out what the problem was and figure out a solution. Edgar and Alan would continue their lunar orbit, traversing the dark side of the moon with a communications blackout as Mission Control got to work. Ed and Alan were hopeful that a solution would be found. It would be depressing to get this close to the moon and not be able to land. The problem was soon diagnosed as a loose particle in the abort button. Mission Control then called MIT computer programmer Don Iles, who wrote the code for the lunar module, and he was tasked with completely reprogramming the lunar module to ignore the erroneous abort signal. This new code was then tested on the lunar module simulators back on Earth. As the Antares emerged from the dark side of the moon and the communications blackout, this new code was transmitted to the lunar module.
Antares, Houston, the computer's yours.
Thank you, you troops did a nice job down there.
That was beautiful.
It was now up to Edgar Mitchell to manually enter each line of this new code into the lunar module computer. One missed character, and the code would not work. Edgar Mitchell understood the pressure he was under, but he remained calm and successfully was able to reprogram the lunar module. And after a brief radar glitch caused by a new code, they were cleared for a descent to the moon.
And Antares, Houston, you're go for Bramaro.
It's a beautiful day to land at Bramaro.
Okay, 3 feet per second, 40 feet, 3 feet per second, 30, 3 feet per second, looking great, 20 feet. 10, 3 feet per second, contact now.
New stop. Brake. Pro. Auto. Auto.
We're on the surface.
Okay, we made a good landing.
Roger, Antares.
413 plus 10,000. That was a beautiful one.
Yeah, we're slightly off. We landed close, but other than that, we're in great shape.
Yep.
Right on the landing site.
Edgar Mitchell and Alan Shepard landed on the moon. The first thing that they did was describe the lunar surface to the geologist and Mission Control. They would then step out of the lunar module and onto the moon. Ed would note that he was happy to be on solid ground. When outside of the lunar module, they had to suit up in their portable life system, which allotted them enough oxygen and water for 5 hours. The first day's extravehicular activity consisted of setting up the American flag and setting up various instruments. Among these was a seismometer, which detected thousands of moonquakes and helped to determine the structure of the moon's interior. Other instruments measured the compositions of the solar winds and the moon's tenuous atmosphere and plasma environment. Shepard and Mitchell also collected rock and soil samples near the landing site. The second day's EA consisted of a hike to explore Frau Maurer's cone crater, 1 mile away from the landing site. As they continued on their hike, the terrain became a lot more rugged than indicated on their training maps. There were so many craters, craters seemed to blend into other craters, and it became really difficult to tell where they were. The hike was now taking longer than they expected, and their life support systems were running out. They eventually got to the edge of Frau Maurer, but were unable to make it to the rim of the cone crater, before Mission Control instructed them to head back to the lunar module. They did collect a bunch of rocks along the way, eventually totaling nearly 100 pounds of lunar samples. Alan and Edgar's moonwalk would be the longest recorded to the Apollo missions, totaling about 5 kilometers. Before entering the lunar module, Alan Shepard would hit a golf ball he had brought along with him and a makeshift 6-iron. Edgar Mitchell would throw a makeshift javelin, and the two of them would proclaim to have the first Olympics in space.
Here we go. Three of the die, one more. Miles and miles and miles.
After being on the moon for 2 days, it was time to take off and reconnect with Stu Russo and the command and service module orbiting above them. Once reconnected, Alan and Edgar got into the command module, and the lunar module was jettisoned, and the crew of Apollo 14 began their return trip to Earth. It would take about 3 days before they returned back to Earth. Now that the getting to the moon portion of the trip was over, Edgar Mitchell felt like he could really relax and take in the experience. It was on his way back to Earth that he had an intense personal experience that would change his life. Here he is recounting the profound experience.
And what happened to me on the way back after we had completed this very exciting and successful voyage of exploration and been the first to explore the Fra Mauro area. But the thing that happened to me as I looked back on Earth and saw it setting, sitting in this bright sky filled with a profusion of stars, was a sudden recognition that I was a part of all of that. The joyous recognition that the molecules of my body, the molecules of our spacecraft, everything that existed was in some sense in communication with every other thing. That it was a holistic picture. That I could reach out and touch in some sense each and every star and each and every galaxy. Billions and billions and billions of miles away, even billions of light years away. And it was a harmonious feeling. It was a feeling the universe is intelligent in some sense. And it was the feeling also that our scientific descriptions are far from complete, and that our religious cosmologies, our descriptions that have come out of our religious teachings and our experience of the subjective side of ourselves, is also flawed. It's incomplete. That in this magnificent evolving universe, we're still a ways from the answers as to who and what we are and how we got here and where we're going. The feeling that the universe is intelligent, in some sense there's purpose in it, and that we're not alone. These were all the feelings that I experienced as I watched this magnificent little planet.
After a successful re-entry and quarantine, the astronauts are finally reunited with their families and took part in all the post-mission media engagements. They made TV appearances, got tours of Capitol from senators, had an elegant dinner with President Nixon, and even got to mingle with their Soviet counterparts. Edgar Mitchell was even honored in his hometown with a highway named after him. It was here that he experienced the first in a series of events in short succession that would change his life and cause him to leave NASA to pursue different interests. Here's Edgar Mitchell recounting what happened when he went home after his Apollo flight.
After my Apollo flight, when I was back in the area and visiting relatives and friends, some of the people in the area who had been involved, what I call the old timers, who were involved in the 1940s, 1947, and subsequent with the Roswell crash, and people like in the sheriff's department who had been to the crash site and were supervising traffic. My friend and friend of our family, the major, who was an office mate of in the administrative function at Walker Air Force Base. These folks, because they had been shushed and told not to talk about their experience by military authority in those days, and on dire consequence if they did, felt that here in the 70s, many, many years later, that they didn't want to go to the grave with their story. They wanted to tell somebody reliable. And being a local boy and having been to the moon, they considered me reliable enough to whisper in my ear their particular story and their association with the Roswell crash.
Edgar Mitchell claims that during this time, various people related to the Roswell crash came out and shared their story with him, indicating that an alien craft had actually crashed all those years ago and bodies were recovered, and the government implemented a strict cover-up. It should be noted that according to Ed, he received these testimonials in the early 1970s, years before Stanton Friedman and Bill Moore would publicly reopen the Roswell case in the late 1970s and early 80s. These revelations Ed received shook him up, and he did not know what to make of them. The next event that affected Ed was a healing experience had by his mother. Reminder, I am not saying to believe this in full, but this is Ed's experience as he claimed, and I am going to tell his story as he would have out of respect for the man. I am not saying I fully believe this, and Edgar himself would acknowledge on multiple occasions how ridiculous this all sounds to those who hadn't experienced it. He had been speaking at a conference in Arkansas, where he met a man named Norbu Chen. Norbu Chen was an American who had studied some of the earliest forms of Tibetan Buddhism, and infused ancient Tibetan shamanistic practices. To many, Norbu was a charlatan. To some, he was a person with genuine healing abilities. Edgar's mother had also driven down to this conference, and Edgar wanted to test Norbu's alleged abilities on his own mother, who for years by that point had been legally blind without her very thick eyeglasses. Edgar asked Norbu if he could cure his mother's vision. The following day, Ed brought his mother to Norbu Chen. She sat in a chair and settled into a relaxed state. Norbu then began singing a strange mantra and floating his hands over her eyes, and after a few minutes, Norbu announced he was finished, and told Ed's mother to go to sleep and treat herself as if she had been through a major surgery. He prescribed her grape juice and broth. The following day, Ed's mother ran into Ed's room, exclaiming that she could see and praised the Lord. Ed performed various tests to check his mother's eyesight. Ed's mother proceeded to drive home multiple hours away without her glasses for the first time in years. This event shook Ed up. His mother was no nonsense, and she had expected this to not work. A week later, Ed's mother called Ed to inform him that she was still able to see without her glasses, and to ask if Norbu was a Christian like she was. Ed had kept this fact from his mother, who was a devout Christian. Ed informed her that Norbu was not a Christian, and Ed's mother exclaimed that this was the work of evil and she wanted no part of it, and a few hours later, her eyesight returned to the poor state it was in before her encounter with Norbu. Ed was perplexed by this series of events, and he did not know what to make of it. Back at NASA, things weren't going well. The media caught wind of Edgar's psychic experiments in space and their not-so-successful results, and had a field day poking fun at this astronaut who they had said had gone off the deep end. Edgar Mitchell recounts that at a breakfast one day, Alan Shepard showed him one of these articles, making fun of Ed's psychic experiment, and said, "Can you believe the kind of stuff they come up with just to sell a story?" There was an awkward silence, then Ed informed Alan Shepard that he had in fact attempted these experiments during their Apollo 14 trip. Alan Shepard looked at Ed and said nothing, and never spoke of these psi experiments with him again, but Ed could tell that Alan was disappointed and angry that their mission was now forever stained by this woo-woo nonsense. Ed soon found that many at NASA shared the sentiments held by Alan Shepard. Few had the guts to say anything to Ed's face, but many at NASA began keeping their distance, staring at him and whispering behind Ed's back. No open hostility, but the mood was now cold. Surprisingly, there was one person who was interested in Ed's moon experiment, his friend, Wernher von Braun. Wernher contacted Ed privately and told him he understood what he was trying to do and that he too was interested in consciousness. He even spoke of the possibility of having NASA fund some of these consciousness-related studies that consumed both of their interests. Wernher asked Ed to assemble a list of NASA facilities, people, and equipment that might be useful for future consciousness studies. Then the subject of Roswell came up, and the recent things Ed had heard on his home trip. This is when Wernher made some big revelations to Ed. Here is Ed recounting Wernher von Braun's relationship to the Roswell incident.
Well, it wasn't just any one person. It was the accumulation of evidence of people. And then some of the the Roswell people, some of the military people, certainly Wernher von Braun, whom I knew quite well, presumably, and according to the stories and what he's told to me also, was supportive, and that the paperclip people from Germany were at Fort Bliss at the time of all this happened. And I became very close to Wernher, and he dropped a few hints. He didn't discuss it with me at great depth, but we did become close enough that he didn't hold it back, really. The point that I really knew from multiple sources saying the same thing, that we didn't have it, that it was all true. Or at least, maybe not all the details. There were differences in details, but by and large, the phenomenon itself was correct. Now, that doesn't mean that he went around talking about it all the time, but he was apparently there and asked to investigate that first incident because of his rocketry knowledge.
Wernher von Braun would soon leave NASA for the private industry, and he and Ed were never able to perform NASA consciousness studies. Ed would serve on the backup crew for Apollo 16, then shortly after, he too would leave NASA. It was no longer for him. He wanted answers that NASA could not provide. What was the feeling he had in outer space? What happened to his mother's vision? What is the phenomena behind what crashed in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947, that many respected members of his hometown attested to, and that was now being attested to by a brilliant man he respected, Wernher von Braun? Were we really being visited by some advanced non-human intelligence? Were all these things somehow related? Ed found that the place that was beginning to ask these kinds of questions were found in what today we call the New Age circles of the 1970s. What drew Ed to these circles was his profound experience in space. He found that Eastern learning helped him understand what he felt more than any Western materialistic view could. Ed soon learned the Eastern concept of samadhi, which best encapsulated the feeling of oneness he had in space. During this time, Ed was known to attend places like the Esalen Institute, a Lawrence Rockefeller-funded institution about an hour south of San Francisco, founded in 1962 with the intention of promoting human potentiality by way of seminars on everything from massages to drug-induced mysticism. What attracted Ed to places like this is these were some of the only places in the West that were studying Eastern mysticism. Esalen became synonymous with the hippie culture that was developing in the United States, and this nonprofit helped bring yoga, organic food, and meditation into the American mainstream. Some notable people who would go through Esalen during the times Ed was there were Allen Ginsberg, writer, poet, and one of the founders of the Beatnik Generation, Timothy Leary, a Harvard psychologist turned rogue critic of the war on drugs and an advocate for mind-altering substances, Alan Watts, an English writer, theologian, and speaker known for interpreting and popularizing Eastern philosophies such as Buddhism, Taoism, and Avati Vedanta for a Western audience, and Joseph Banks Ryan, the Duke University parapsychology person whose work Ed had been following for years at that point. It should be noted I did come across some stuff researching that would indicate that the CIA would use Esalen as a front for when they wanted to do experiments relating to psychedelics and stuff like channeling. I'm not completely sure about this, but it would not surprise me. Some go as far as to say that this place, Esalen, was a continuation of MKUltra. I would love to see some discussion in the comments about Esalen. It's kind of a weird little subset of history that I want to know more about. It was in these circles Ed would meet people like Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ of SRI, two young scientists beginning to look into ESP, and Andrea Piharik, a Chicago-born medical and parapsychology researcher. Ed appreciated how places like Esalen were attempting to study things he had been interested in but couldn't do at NASA. Pretty soon, Ed decided that he wanted to create his own institution on the Esalen model that would study phenomena related to his interests like consciousness, remote healing, and psi research. UFOs would wait for now. Using the Esalen model, he would set out to create his own version of the consciousness studies he and Wernher von Braun had spoke of years before they had left NASA. He eventually founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences, or IONS, in 1973. The word noetic derives from the Greek word nous, meaning mind or way of knowing. The Institute conducts research on topics such as spontaneous remission, meditation, consciousness, consciousness-based healthcare, spirituality, human potential, psychic abilities, psychokinesis, and the survival of consciousness after bodily death. Wernher von Braun would speak at many of the early IONS fundraising benefits to help raise money for his friend Ed's new venture, and eventually Ed was able to open up a campus in Petaluma, California, about an hour north of San Francisco. This sudden change of lifestyle was too much for Ed's wife, and they soon separated. Ed was sad about that, but excited to be pursuing interests he had had on the back burner for years.
Ninel Kulagina is a Russian housewife who has this ability. These films of her demonstrating PK were made in a Russian hotel room and smuggled out of the country by American researchers.
Information leaked from the Soviet Union about an alleged woman with telekinetic abilities named Ninel Kulagina, who was being studied by the Soviet scientific community. I have a separate video where I cover Ninel. She has an interesting story whether you look at it as a woman with legit abilities or you view the psychic arms race as two superpowers playing an elaborate game of disinfo in the hopes of bankrupting the other. Nevertheless, news of Ninel Kulagina suddenly made the intelligence services in America interested in finding their own Ninel who they could study. The Americans would find their own Ninel Kulagina in an Israeli man named Yuri Geller. Here Ed's story comes across another interesting person from history. And reminder, I'm not telling you to believe Yuri Geller. And I'm not saying I believe everything Yuri Geller says. In short, Yuri Geller is to many a flamboyant charlatan and a magician faking psychic abilities, having been exposed by James Randi and failed attempts at his stunts on shows like Johnny Carson.
Dark, we are back. Uri was telling me you don't feel what, strong tonight?
I don't feel strong. It's not all tonight. Right now I'm feeling being pressed and then I can't.
Well, I'm not trying to press you. I really not.
Telling me, well, will you try that or that or that?
And to others, like Edgar Mitchell, Yuri Geller is a person with legitimate psychic abilities, with weird statements like this coming from former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Everybody came in and they wanted to see Uri, because Uri is very famous. You know, he's very famous Israelis. How many people know Israelis? Uri is a brand name for Israel. Anyway, they all came to see him, and they all wanted to have his spoons. He said, I can't do it right now. I can't bend all the spoons. I said, well, he's very gracious, you know. But they said, could you bend our spoons? Could you bend our spoons? They said, oh, all right. So he stood at one corner of the restaurant and he simultaneously bent the spoons of all the people who were there.
In his own words, Yuri Geller would receive his abilities after an interaction with the light orb when he was a child. From that light orb emerged a shadow figure that showed a light on Yuri, and from that point he had powers in things like intuition, manifesting objects, telekinesis, spoon bending. And remember, this is all according to Yuri. Eventually, Yuri would catch the attention of Israeli intelligence agency Mossad and the CIA. Annie Jacobson reports in her book Phenomena that the CIA wanted to study Yuri Geller, so they sent Andrea Piharik to go get him from Israel. Piharik was able to convince Geller to come to America to be studied. It is alleged he was probably working for Mossad during this time. Anyways, now that Geller was on board with being studied, there just needed to be a way for the CIA to study with a layer of deniability. Annie Jacobson reports that Piharik and the CIA saw Edgar Mitchell and the Institute of Noetic Sciences as the perfect conduit for these efforts. The CIA used the Institute of Noetic Sciences as a buffer for their interest in studying the alleged Israeli psychic. Edgar Mitchell would help connect Piharik and Geller with Stanford Research Institute scientists Russell Targ and Hal Pudoff. Edgar Mitchell claims he was initially skeptical of Yuri Geller, but two things convinced him. First, Ed challenged Yuri to materialize a camera that he had jettisoned on the moon 2 years prior. Nothing happened. Then when Yuri was eating ice cream, he screamed out in pain, opened his mouth, which was now bleeding, and a weird arrow emblem popped out. No one at the table recognized the weird artifact except Ed, who recognized it as extremely similar to an archery emblem he had previously owned and lost years before ever meeting Yuri. This emblem was part of a box Ed had lost containing various personal artifacts. Ed then claims, throughout the course of the day, two separate distinct emblems from his lost box appeared around the SRI labs. Ed hadn't told anyone about his lost emblem box, so he was pretty shocked to see these three exact items appear all on the same day. The other strange thing that convinced Ed of Yuri's alleged abilities was that during this early SRI intermingling time, the SRI crew would put some of Yuri's spoonbending on local TV stations in the SF Bay Area. Ed then claims that they would get calls from families all over the Bay Area where their children would be bending spoons with their minds, like Yuri. Ed and other SRI folk would go investigate, often bringing their own spoons, and witness these children bending these objects with their minds. Ed would be so impressed by Yuri that he eventually introduced him to Wernher von Braun. Now, one can think that Yuri Geller is a lying charlatan and that Wernher von Braun is a war criminal and that he should have been executed at Nuremberg, but I think we all have to just take a moment to appreciate how strange and interesting this meeting even was. An Israeli psychic and a former Nazi and NASA rocket scientist crossing paths all because of Edgar Mitchell. Apparently, Yuri and Werner got into a big heated argument about World War II, because many of Yuri's Jewish ancestors had been killed in World War II. Eventually, they were able to cool their heads, and Werner apologized for all the harm they had done. Nevertheless, Stanford Research Institute's testing of Uri Geller and his alleged abilities began because of Edgar Mitchell.
With Uri Geller, this is Edgar Mitchell, who, with his eyes covered, is trying to pick up the number that Geller is sending. Also, we see Wilbur Franklin of Kent State, Harold Puthoff, and Russell Targ of SRI, along with Don Chuick, Vice President for Research at SRI.
The testing on Uri Geller at Stanford Research Institute included some testing into remote viewing, or the alleged ability of getting impressions or images of a target from a distance. Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff would go on to run the CIA DIA remote viewing program called Project Stargate. This program ran for 20 years officially, and some allege that it is still being run today in the private sector, usually in secrecy, with some slip-ups every now and then, like this slip-up from President Jimmy Carter.
One time we had a small plane go down somewhere in Africa, and we were not able to find it by surveillance. So the director of the CIA heard about a woman in California that was a medium or something, I don't know the title for, and she gave him the latitude and longitude of the plane's whereabouts. We located the plane where she said it was. And that's the only time that I have ever experienced something that was inexplicable while I was present.
Annie Jacobson and Edgar Mitchell both report that Edgar Mitchell was often asked to represent Project Stargate on behalf of senators and different department heads. Being an astronaut, he was thought of as the respected liaison between this anomalous program and the government that funded it. Annie Jacobson reports that Edgar Mitchell even briefed then CIA Director George H.W. Bush on the status of the government remote viewing program in 1980. Through the 1980s, he continued his work assisting Project Stargate when needed and focusing on the Institute of Noetic Science. In the 1990s is when Ed really started to include UFOs more into his public interest. In the 1990s is when he first went public with the testimonies of people from his hometown of Roswell relating to the crashed UFO back in 1947.
Do you think it's more likely than not that extraterrestrials have been to this planet?
From what I now understand and have experienced and seen the evidence for, I think the evidence is very strong. And large portions of it are classified.
He started speaking at conferences and began being involved with many of the public UFO initiatives of the day. He was a part of the Rockefeller UFO Initiative. This initiative was promoted by Lawrence Rockefeller, remember, an investor of Esalen Institute, interesting, and asked for all UFO information held by the government, including from the CIA and the US Air Force, to be released to the public. It featured many big ufologists of the 1990s like Stephen Greer, Linda Moulton Howe, Robert Bigelow, and Dr. John Mack. Edgar Mitchell then went on to sit on the Scientific Advisory Board of the National Institute of Discovery Sciences, the UFO and paranormal research investigation organization created by billionaire real estate tycoon Robert Bigelow. I have a separate video where I cover the life of Robert Bigelow. I recommend checking out. Edgar Mitchell served on this board along with people like Jacques Vallée, CIA analyst Kit Green, Eric Davis, and Ed's old SRI friend Hal Puthoff. This group investigated things like cattle mutilation and UFO reports, and this group would eventually evolve into BAS, which would receive the government contract to study UFOs. Edgar Mitchell was also a part of Stephen Greer's 2001 Disclosure Initiative. He initially thought highly of Greer, but grew to dislike him over time, as he claims Greer would often misrepresent what he would say. In 2004, Edgar Mitchell would be a part of another infamous part of UFO lore, the Wilson-Davis memo. Here is Edgar Mitchell telling his story in relation to this infamous event.
Well, I eventually went to the Pentagon and asked for a meeting with the Intelligence Committee of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which I got with another naval officer who had had many similar experiences. And we told our story, and this gentleman, a vice admiral, said to us, well, I don't know about that, but I'm going to find out, and called a few weeks later and said he had found the source of the black budget funding for this project, and that he was going to subsequently investigate, because if it was real, he should know about it. As a matter of fact, he should be in charge. That was his words. And so we did get calls from him sometime later, and a report much later than that, that he had found the people
responsible for the cover-up and for the people who were in the know, and were told, I'm sorry, Admiral, you do not have need to know here.
So this alleged meeting and subsequent notes allegedly taken by Eric Davis are highly debated in the UFO community, with some like Richard Dolan calling this the UFO leak of the century and a clear sign of the stovepiping the government takes relating to UFOs, and others like John Greenwald of the Black Vault stating that there really isn't enough evidence to take this as anything more than a story. I would have to make a whole video specifically dedicated to this topic to fully flesh it out, so I will link some interesting discussions had from both sides of this argument regarding the Wilson-Davis memo in the description.
Joined by a distinguished American in West Palm Beach, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut, sixth man to walk on the moon. Many of the Roswell witnesses told Dr. Mitchell their accounts, which he says were later verified by a contact at the Pentagon. What do you believe?
The question of extraterrestrial life has puzzled people for decades. Apollo 14 astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell, he was the sixth man to walk on the moon, and he says he's certain we are not alone in the universe. He's now speaking out about why he thinks the government actually knows this.
Starting in the 2000s, Ed had become more vocal than ever about UFOs and the need for serious addressal by the government and society, appearing in countless interviews on the radio and on national cable news. This was in a time when representing UFOs on these programs often resulted in jokes and sneers. He would often be seen at UFO conferences during this time and began doing the mid-2000s UFO podcast circuit. He was a part of Stephen Bassett's 2013 initiative, Citizen Hearing on Disclosure, which publicly lobbied the Obama administration to release the UFO files. In later years, he launched the Edgar Mitchell Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters, or FREE. FREE is a scientific organization focused on consciousness and contact experiences. They collect data on alleged contactees to this day. The Institute of Noetic Sciences is also running to this day. Ed also kept up with many of the Apollo astronauts going to memorials and functions for children. There is a funny story where he tried to sell a small NASA camera that he was supposed to leave on the moon. NASA sued him in a lawsuit titled The United States vs. Edgar Mitchell, resulting in him having to relinquish the camera to NASA and NASA having to update their procedures. Edgar Mitchell's name also appeared in 2016 WikiLeaks. There is indication that this was likely someone spamming John Podesta using Edgar Mitchell's name, and there is no back and forth communication between Podesta or Mitchell. I will link some further reading on this below. Edgar Mitchell died under hospice care in West Palm Beach, Florida at the age of 85 on February 4th, 2016. Unfortunately, Edgar Mitchell didn't live to see the Pentagon UFO program revelation and subsequent seriousness in the media. You know he would have done the news and podcast circuit, and it would have been so delightful to see these developments we are currently living through. At his funeral, family spoke, as well as many friends from various chapters of his life, and even his old roommate Fred Hayes, who Edgar helped save the life of during the Apollo 13 disaster. Like I said in the beginning, we might not agree with all of his conclusions, but we can appreciate the advocacy he did for UFOs and the service he did for America. Rest in peace, Edgar Mitchell.